Today is Monday, August 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, North and South Korea have announced their leaders will meet for a third time. U.S. officials have visited South America in recent weeks to signal strength and inter-American alliances amid U.S. competitors' increased interest in the region.
We would want to make sure that we were that security partner of choice.
Plus, Turkey has accused Washington and other countries of waging economic war against it, and a Chicago zoo has a birthday. An iconic attraction turns 150. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. North and South Korea have agreed to hold a summit in Pyongyang in September. Reuters' Grace Lee reports it's the latest step forward in cross-border ties this year after more high-level talks.
South Korea's president plans to cross over to the North in September for an unprecedented third summit with leader Kim Jong-un. On Monday, the two Koreas held a fresh round of talks at the DMZ to discuss details and announced the summit would be held in the capital of Pyongyang. It's a step forward, but not without tension over the North's nuclear program.
I think if we talk about our problems, this will be an opportunity to find the solutions that our country is looking for.
Ri Sung-kwon, the chairman of North Korea's reunification committee, was cryptic on Monday, saying it's important to clear obstacles that prevent relations between the two from moving forward. And if they aren't, unexpected problems could emerge. It's not clear what exactly Ri was talking about, but Seoul says the two leaders will be discussing the North's pledge to denuclearize at the next summit. South Korea's Moon Jae-in has already met with Kim twice at the border village of Panmunjom earlier this year. Kim Jong-un, on the other hand, has had a busy schedule. He's held a flurry of diplomatic summits with the leaders of China and the U.S., plus Vladimir Putin invited him to Moscow. At his landmark meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump in June, Kim made a broad promise towards denuclearization. But according to U.S. officials, Pyongyang has yet to agree to a timeline for getting rid of its weapons or disclosing its size.
That was Reuters' Grace Lee. High-profile U.S. officials have visited South America in recent weeks to signal strength in their inter-American alliances amid U.S. competitors' increased interest in the region. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis and Chief of Naval Operations Admiral John Richardson. Babb asked Secretary Mattis about China and Russian activity in the region. Mattis told VOA that going back a couple of hundred years ago, you see the external powers trying to operate in North America and South America.
We have gone through many difficult periods between our nations, among our nations, and there's more than one way to lose sovereignty in this world. It's not just by bayonets. It can also be by countries that come in bearing gifts and large loans and things like we have seen in other parts of the world that Prime Minister Modi of India talks about piling massive debt on countries knowing they will not be able to repay it, or large projects where people don't get, the locals don't get the jobs for them. Other countries bring in their own workers, and then they lose political sovereignty to that sort of thing. We want free and independent democratic countries in our hemisphere. We believe that's what every country deserves, is their own decision-making. We do not believe that other countries should have vetoes.
Speaking to reporters while traveling to Brazil on Sunday, Mattis said Russian and Chinese involvement in South America has had zero impact on military-to-military relationships with America's Latin partners. Admiral Richardson explained what the United States can use to counter the influence of Russia and China. He told VOA the United States wanted to make sure it was the security partner of choice.
So when we think about operating, whether it's the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, any of the services, you know, let's make sure that we continue to be interoperable, that you know, we would want to be the first choice to be a teammate there, whether that's operating together, whether that's exchanging gear. You know, we have a great history with these nations of personnel exchanges. They come to our war colleges and schools. We go to theirs. Had a chance to meet a bunch of those folks when I was down there. You know, these strategic relationships are really matter. And so in that security space, we would want to be the partner of choice. Then, you know, there's the stability that these security relationships provide offer a lot of flexibility for the other elements of national power, whether those be diplomatic or economic, to work their part of those relationships as well. But we want to be that stable, steady, committed team that will be there for one another when the chips are down.
The U.S. Navy has been partnering with Latin American allies to combat illicit trafficking, particularly as it pertains to narcotics. Allies are also mindful of transitional types of terror threats, with partners in the Caribbean keeping a close watch for piracy, a crime Richardson called terrorism at sea. Officials say other security areas are ripe for inter-American military cooperation, from humanitarian missions to cybersecurity. Among other top stories, battles between Afghan security forces and the Taliban continued for a fourth straight day in Afghan's southeastern city of Ghazni. An Afghan minister says about 100 police and soldiers have been killed, along with 20 civilians. Zimbabwe's president has called on the troubled country to unite in his first public address since winning disputed elections. Voice of America's Mandarin Service correspondent and a multimedia journalist were detained Monday evening by Chinese police while attempting to interview a retired Chinese professor who was taken away by authorities during a live television interview with VOA nearly 2 weeks ago. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
In the early 2000s, scientists uncovered an odd-looking, tiny lizard-like fossil in the Dolomites Mountains of northern Italy. An international team of paleontologists then set out to learn about the fossil's identity and origins. A new study published in the journal Nature reveals their findings. It turns out that the 76-millimeter-long fossil dates back 240 to 250 million years and has been identified as an ancient lizard species called Megachirella. The researchers say what they encountered is the oldest lizard fossil ever found. The study also reveals that the Megachirella is 75,000 years older than what were previously thought to be the oldest fossil lizards, leading some in the science community to call this ancient species the mother of all lizards and snakes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. The Turkish currency strengthened against the dollar after reaching a record low early Monday as authorities in Ankara prepared to implement an economic action plan. The lira has lost more than 40% of its value this year amid tensions with the U.S. and the country's high debt level. Turkey is also trying to tamp down rising inflation. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accused NATO ally Washington and other countries of waging economic war against his country, citing Trump administration steel and aluminum tariffs, which President Donald Trump said Friday he would double to 20%. The two countries are at odds over the incarceration of American Protestant minister Andrew Brunson, the U.S. conviction of a Turkish banker, the extradition request for exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, and Turkey's closer defense ties with Russia. The Brunson impasse sparked sanctions and counter-sanctions. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal told VOA's Victor Beatty the Turkish economy has been in trouble for months.
The economy is heavily dependent on foreign capital. And that foreign capital is now has to be repaid. The current account deficit is quite large. And with the pressure on the lira, there has been a tendency to walk away from lira, which complicates matters in the sense that now Turkey will have even less resources available to repay. The problem has been compounded by a policy that was implemented by the United States, doubling the tariffs on steel imports from Turkey and aluminum imports. So the new model that they are trying to pursue is a very odd one. The reality is that this is a stage where when you increase the interest rates in order to be able to discourage capital outflows and encourage capital inflows, number one. Number two, you tend to control the overheated economy so that inflationary pressures don't develop. they instead are going to lower or keep the interest rates low. Presumption being that if we keep the interest rates low, there'll be larger investment, and that will then create more output in the economy, and the inflation will be taken care of, and there'll be increased confidence in the economy, and that will lead to improvement in the lira condition. Now, this is a very, very iffy situation. The model that they're trying to formulate is not necessarily the right model, but it's a political response to an economic problem. The point at this moment is thinner elements should prevail and should try to resolve the problem right here, because solution to the political problem is not the economic retaliation. The minute you do economic retaliation, you lose control over the political and diplomatic issues, as well as cause problems that you will not necessarily be able to handle when the economy, global economy, starts to spin out of control.
Well, as you know, a Turkish delegation came to Washington to discuss some of the issues between Turkey and the U.S., but apparently went away with no progress.
That's right. And that's the dangerous part of it all. You see, remember, the problem actually is not new. This has been going on since the abortive coup. Whether one likes it or not, the Turks continue to blame the American interest in that coup. The same thing has happened to the Russian ruble. The Russian ruble has fallen dramatically too, for the same reason restrictions were imposed or threatened against Russia. So, I mean, you know, these things don't work. I mean, don't take the exchange rate as lightly as people seem to be doing. Try to solve the problem by the instruments that are available for a particular issue. Not try to widen it, expand it, because it almost ends up a situation where it doesn't really matter what's the problem. You use only one instrument that you have in your hands, and that is a tariff rate. Doesn't work.
Zubair Iqbal said, while Mr. Erdogan threatens to find new friends and alliances, the longer this dispute drags on and escalates, the greater threat it poses to the global economic order. As such, Asia shares in markets skidded, and the euro hit one-year lows on Monday as renewed rout in the Turkish lira drove demand for safe harbors, including the U.S. dollar, the Swiss franc, and the yen. Reuters' Ed Giles has that story.
It's been a rough few days in the world's emerging markets, led by a currency crisis in Turkey. Asian shares skidded on Monday, and the euro hit one-year lows after the Turkish lira plunged even deeper over the weekend. Japan's Nikkei lost 1.6%, China's blue chip index lost 1.4%, and Hong Kong's stocks were also down 1.6%. Investors globally headed for safe harbours, including the US dollar, as the sell-off in Turkey spread to emerging markets abroad, including South Africa's rand. At one point, the lira hit an all-time low of more than 7.2 against the dollar. Since this time last month, it's almost lost a third of its value. Turkey moved to put investors at ease this weekend after the country's finance minister said an economic action plan would be put into place on Monday. But analysts told Reuters the plunge in Turkey's lira looked certain to push the country's economy into recession and had the potential to trigger a banking crisis in the country. That could be a big blow for emerging markets more broadly, but one analyst told Reuters, with a GDP smaller than the Netherlands, spillover from Turkey may be modest. A dispute between Turkey and the US has weighed on the lira. The two NATO allies have been at odds over Syria and Turkey's ambition to buy Russian defense systems. But anger has flared up recently over evangelical pastor Andrew Brunson. He's on trial in Turkey for allegedly belonging to a terrorist group. In July, Brunson was moved to house arrest after spending 20 months in prison. Donald Trump has tweeted that he wants the pastor released. On Friday, Trump announced the US was doubling tariffs on steel and aluminium from Turkey, saying relations were, quote, not good at this time.
That was Reuters' Ed Giles. More than 430 people have now been confirmed dead from last week's devastating earthquake that struck off the Indonesian island of Lombok. VOA's Martin Sechrist has more.
A spokesman for Indonesia's Natural Disaster Agency said the death toll continues to rise as search and rescue crews reach affected villages cut off from the outside world by the disaster. He said efforts to deliver emergency aid to remote villages have been hampered by damaged roads on Lombok. In a statement, the agency said the damage is and losses are very large, adding that economic damage from the earthquake has risen to at least $342 million. The 6.9 magnitude quake, which struck off the waters of the northern part of Lombok Island on August 5th, killed at least 436 people. The earthquake forced nearly 390,000 people to flee their homes, leaving roughly 10% of Lombok's population homeless or displaced. Authorities say about 68,000 homes have been damaged or destroyed. A school aimed at helping children recover from the trauma of the earthquake has been set up in a refugee camp on Lombok Island. Army psychologist Rutta Yaman visited the school in the village of Tanjung and conducted positive activities to eliminate trauma caused by the quake.
The first time we arrived, they still looked scared and only lived in tents without doing anything. So we built this school, as we have one in Sambunan village, to restore their mentality, to be ready to face this reality.
This is the second deadly earthquake to hit Lombok within the last few weeks. A 6.4 magnitude quake on July 29th killed 17 people. Indonesia is prone to earthquakes due to its location on the Pacific Ring of Fire, an arc of volcanoes and fault lines in the Pacific Ocean Basin. In December 2004, a magnitude 9.1 earthquake off Sumatra Island triggered a tsunami that killed 230,000 people in a dozen countries. Martin Seacrest, VOA News.
And this is International Edition.
Come celebrate the 60th birthday of legendary King of Pop, Michael Jackson, on Wednesday, August 29th, with a very special edition of Border Crossings. Join Larry London as he takes you back through time with a full hour of Michael Jackson's greatest hits. With a career spanning over 40 years, Michael Jackson gave us plenty of songs to choose from. Don't miss Border Crossings on Wednesday, August 29th at 1500 Universal, as we pay tribute to one of the greatest pop stars of all time.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, fresh off a two-nation Africa visit to Zimbabwe and Malawi, Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered reporting on democracy in Africa. On the road with Shaka on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. Google records your movements even when you explicitly tell it not to. This affects some 2 billion users of Android devices and hundreds of millions of worldwide iPhone users who rely on Google for maps or search. The AP's Julie Walker reports.
An Associated Press investigation shows using Google services on Android devices and iPhones allows the company to record your whereabouts as you go about your day, even if you've used privacy settings that are supposed to prevent it from doing so. Google stores time-stamped location data when its Maps app is simply opened. Automatic daily weather updates pinpoint roughly where you are. And some searches that have nothing to do with location, like searching chocolate chip cookies, are pinned with precise coordinates down to the square foot to your Google account. I'm Julie Walker.
One of the oldest zoos in the United States is the Chicago Lincoln Park Zoo. In 2018, it's celebrating a big milestone, its 150th anniversary. The zoo opened in 1868 with just 2 pairs of swans. The zoo has a considerably larger collection today, but its priorities haven't changed that much. VOA's Jeff Custer reports the zoo remains focused on conservation, preserving rare species, organizing educational programmings, and setting an example for future generations of animal lovers.
Adrian Horrigan said Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo started 150 years ago with a gracious gift from New York City officials.
When the commissioners of the Board of Public Works of the City of Chicago received a gift of 2 pairs of swans from the commissioners of Central Park in New York City. The gift was actually arranged by 2 brothers, a man named Andrew Green, who is quite famous for starting a lot of the famous cultural institutions in New York City, and his brother, who is working for the Illinois-Michigan Canal.
The swans appear to have brought the zoo good luck. Today, their descendants still float gracefully in the zoo's pond. But there's a lot more to see now. Spread across 5 square kilometers, the Lincoln Park Zoo boasts a spacious pool for sea lions, big pavilions for predators, and giant spaces for herbivores. With more than 200 different species of animals on display, it's a popular attraction that draws about 3 million visitors each year.
I do visit the zoo often. We live in Chicago, and I wasn't aware that it was the anniversary, so that's fantastic.
But with the Earth's climate changing and the loss of natural habitats, many of the animal species on display are fighting for their survival. Ben Hunt works with one such species, penguins.
This species of penguins, African penguins, are endangered in the wild, and we're part of a species survival plan, working with other zoos to support the population. And so that's really good news here. When we had that chick born, he's about 4 months now, and he's already almost as big as his parents.
A lot of people believe penguins only live in the icy Antarctic, but these little ones come from South Africa. Chicago's climate is very similar to their natural home, so the birds feel right at home with the Windy City's snowy winters and warm summers.
But I think this is one of the best enclosures for penguins I've seen yet.
Ben Hunt says the zoo has always been free and started as a civic park.
The question came up early in the zoo's history, sometime in the 1870s, of whether we should start charging for some buildings to sort of maintain and pay for the animals' upkeep. The commissioners in the 1870s decided no, it would always remain free.
A lot has changed at Lincoln Park Zoo over the last century and a half, but some things remain the same. For visitors and animal researchers, it's a place to appreciate nature and cherish the wildlife that live among us. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Before I go, on this day in 1846, the American flag was raised for the very first time in the city of Los Angeles. And in 1910, Florence Nightingale, the founder of modern nursing, died in a London area at the age of 90. And that is going to do it for me and this edition of International Edition. Patrice Martin directed the program and John Dryden engineered the broadcast. Before I go, I would like to thank you for taking time out of your day to join us. To stay up with the latest pictures, video stories, and more, follow VOA on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Why would a U.S. government agency specializing in administering civilian foreign aid and development assistance concern itself with religious freedom in the countries where it works? At USAID, we see freedom of worship as an essential element in our pursuit of government that is citizen-centered and citizen-responsive, said USAID Administrator Mark Green. It is inseparable from freedoms of expression, assembly, association, and freedom from discrimination. But a more practical reason is that faith-based organizations frequently work with USAID to deliver development assistance or humanitarian relief to marginalized people. Faith-based partners are often uniquely trusted in those forgotten communities, said Administrator Green. Religious liberty matters because it enables faith-based groups to work with USAID and others without surrendering their essential faith character. Religious intolerance, on the other hand, frequently drives violence and oppression, marginalization and persecution of entire populations. To see what unchecked intolerance looks like, we need look no further than ISIS and the atrocities it has committed. At USAID, because we really look at freedom of worship as a core human right, we're supporting programs to address religious hate speech and interfaith conflict to promote the strengthening and enforcement of laws that protect religious freedom and to increase the capacity of civil society to advocate for it, said Administrator Green. This includes technical assistance and financial support for civil society. USAID is presently undertaking reforms to its partnership and procurement process to make partnering with NGOs and civil society groups easier. At the same time, to help prevent the worst manifestations of religious intolerance before they cause harm, USAID is working to assemble metrics to measure capacity and commitment in the countries where it is active, such as the capacity of civil society and the inclusiveness of government policies. Finally, working with its partners, USAID aims to reinforce and strengthen ethnic and religious pluralism where it has historically existed. It isn't about the content of faith, it never has been, said Administrator Green. It's about society's tolerance for multiple faith traditions. We believe that religious pluralism is part of a cultural mosaic. We believe it is worth preserving as a matter of development as well as an expression of our values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.